listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
As important, or possibly even more important than that, is using sound to captivate people and get them interested in biodiversity. It's all about exposing people. We bring people in here and play sounds for them back in the studio that just blow their socks off. But what they do after they've had an experience like that is they go out there and they listen to that robin in their backyard a little differently than they did before. And by kind of exposing them to the exotic, you get them to pay more attention to their own backyard. Exotic sometimes just means something they haven't heard before that is in their backyard. For example, leafhoppers and treehoppers and those kinds of things that, you know, those are not from the jungles of the Amazon. Those are from our own backyard here, but people don't hear them because you need certain kind of equipment to hear them. And making people aware that here are animals communicating with each other and living their lives in a really interesting way right there in the woods behind your house.
You take the winter wren song and slow it to half speed. You know?
Yeah, that's another thing you do. Take something that they can hear right here and make them listen to it in different ways. And slowing it down is the best way, which is a good thing to do because the birds, that's a closer representation to what the birds hear because they have much better temporal resolution than humans do.
What's one or two of your favorite sounds in this archive?
Yeah, there are a few species out there that are pretty spectacular because of their musicality. Some of the true songbirds are really stunning. From an anthropogenic perspective, they're so human-like, or they're beyond human, they're superhuman. So the musician wren is a favorite of many people and a bird of legend, you know, and it's known as the flautista in much of its range in South America. And it just sounds like someone with the most gorgeous whistle, just happily whistling along.
The reason we're here is to collect and preserve recordings of nature, natural history recordings of basically animals doing what they do in nature, facilitate the ability of other people to collect that kind of material, and then put it out there for people to use, whether it's for science or education or the arts. This archive started as a sound archive in 1929.
So we archive not only audio, but video as well. So this is the collection storage area that climate. Around the perimeter of the room is the video collection and back into an alcove over here. And that comprises about 60,000 clips. Wow. And then in the compact area is the analog audio collection in its final form. We've just completed digitization. It was a 10-year-long effort to convert all of these analog archived recordings to digital files. Typically are focal recordings where you're after an individual species and trying to separate it from the background. We also have environmental recordings which are longer.
This is a hard disk storage system. We, in the audio side, we archival protocol requires that you store your media in not only different locations, but also in different media. But we have to migrate away from that particular media. It's like spinning disc. Eventually, we'll have to migrate from spinning disc to something else. Digital's actually very, very fragile. Mm-hmm. And if that's your entire cultural heritage, how do you try to ensure that it's going to be available? Well, you put it on various media. There's tape backup that people use. Again, you don't want to store everything on one particular media at any one time. But it's a challenge. It's you think about it, like, that's it. It's all going to be bits. The law of impermanence is absolutely...
I love...
Like, you hear that, well, that's fans. That noise is off.
Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty... It's pretty warm back there. Yeah.
The reason I'm in marine acoustic is because of the blue whale sound I hear or didn't hear when I was working here, because they're vocalizing between like 17 and 20 hertz. The sensation of that sound was something that was absolutely something I couldn't believe how strong that was.
Elephants, being huge animals, can make extremely low frequency sounds, and the low frequency sounds travel further through the environment, and it's especially helpful to have low frequency sound in something like a forest that where there's lots of potential interference with the trees, because low frequency sounds get less disturbed by objects than high frequency sounds, because these infrasonic sounds travel a long way. You know, we can pick up on our recorder, we can pick up a low frequency sound that's made maybe nearly a kilometer away.
This is a recording done in the Central African Republic in a large clearing they call the Bai. That's where Katie Payne is doing her elephant research.
Mm-hmm.
Bill made this recording.
This was done with in surround.
This is your recording.
Mm-hmm. We'll play just part of it.
Here we're just hearing the upper registers of what is probably a very low frequency signal.
Yeah, it goes on and on. We have 12
wow.
hours of this.
It's amazing. If you close your eyes, it really is like you feel like you're there.
You bet.
Sound just has an amazing ability to transport people
yeah.
in a way that even the yeah. best visuals I don't think can pull off alone.
I agree.
What should we play next, Greg?
The fact that they can be heard for a kilometer away, sort of, it opens up elephant studies more than you could ever do standing there watching an elephant. Because if you're standing next to an elephant watching it, you have no idea that it's communicating with something a mile away. Humans, obviously... For me, that blows my mind. Mm-hmm. But we have no concept of that you could say something and have it heard miles away. So I think that's sort of the unique thing that we can do with the microphones, that it opens up sort of the ecology of it and more information about the elephants than we could ever get just through observations.
There are these other perceptual systems that other organisms have, and they perceive the world in different ways, and sound is essential to those ways, and it's different. So, you know, let's think about that.
The solitaires as a whole, which are thrushes, but incredibly intricate sounds, cascading water and tinkling of ice. Birds have an organ that allows them to produce two sounds simultaneously. The sounds can be separate, they can be combined to create a third, but the solitaires have this great ability to use both sides of the syrinx. One of my favorite solitaires in the world is brownback solitaire, and the slateback solitaire, also found in Mexico, is equally stunning. Here in the northern 48, we have what's called Townsend solitaire, and its performance is more athletic. It's more like a great athlete who just can do it all. But it's not beautiful, but it's incredibly complex.
So it's quite an athletic endeavor, this field recording business. That sounds like demands patience, stamina, endurance.
Batteries.
Yeah, a lot of batteries. You don't have to go far afield to do this, though, and contribute to something new. That's the amazing thing. There are sounds of cardinals that have never been recorded.
As a child, it was a bribe. If my mother could go, I'm from downstate, I'm from Sullivan County, and my mom and dad would go bird watching. Actually, dad would pick them out, and mom would point the binoculars. But in order to get something from the Dairy Queen, we had to be quiet while they birded.
People used to apparently go out and just like an event was to listen to the nightingales,
I remember trying to talk to sparrows and robins in my grandmother's backyard. I got really fascinated by the ivory-billed woodpecker. We did put up recording devices all through the woods, and we got some that could be the birds, calling, or their distinctive drum beat. They go bam bam, like just a double mm-hmm. knock. And yeah, so that was an interesting project. And of course, we were all about sound then. We were just listening and recording and looking at sonograms, trying to, so I really got into it then.
Well, for elephants, for our elephants, because we study the forest elephant, which is different to the savannah elephant, and it lives deep in the rainforest, the Congo rainforest. And apart from coming out into forest clearings for a brief part of their weekly life, you can't see these elephants at all. So the only kind of practical way you can study them really is through listening to them.
I really enjoy listening to the Arctic sounds. We have a lot of data from that part of the world because of the work with the bowhead census that Chris Clark has done, and listening to the combination of a bowhead whale, the beluga whale, and the bearded seal all together when they're all making that sound. It's just wonderful. The kind of sound that I came to become quite interested in during all of that experimental music work, where it just all this stuff happening that you just really don't know. Well, I wrote a paper and sort of was focused on this idea of anticipating the unexpected. The auto-buoy, next step on the tour, is where we're transmitting in real time.
There is also something, kind of a device at the bottom of it. When you send a signal, it burns and it releases that buoy and it pops up to the surface. And that's why the nickname for this are pop-ups. What we have in those real-time buoys is that it has it records the soundscape, and it also has an algorithm where it can listen for a certain type of signal. And we have found, if you will, this is like kind of a Nike checkmark type of signal. That is one of the signature call of right whale, and that's one of the more reliable predictor of a right whale presence in an area. Mm-hmm. So we designed an algorithm to look for that sound. And when it finds that sound, it can make a clip and send it to us. And when we assign an annotation to that clip, it then feeds the information back to the buoy. And that's what you see over here, that we look.
So we have a number of, the whales are definitely there.
This is recorded with hydrophones, penetrations through the ice, and it was a large microphone array, which Chris then used the arrival time delay between the different microphones to localize, to determine where an individual is singing. So you're hearing multiple bearded seals. They are the bomb-like, cartoon bomb-like sound. They're displaying for females vocalizing. Water lapping against the surface ice, and then beneath that you hear, it's a bowhead whale singing. Inuit usually do is put a kayak paddle up to their ear, the bone in their skull, with the paddle in the water and pick up some vibration. Mm. But you're not going to hear this type of fidelity. Mm. So we've been able to transduce this material. And for human airborne listening, we've slowed down the arrival time of the different microphone signals to approximate what it would be like if you could hear in water as though you were listening in air. So the arrival time of these sounds would have actually been much faster to anyone listening in water. There are some devices that will help with hearing through bone conduction when you're underwater. And then this is one of the very first bat detection devices used by Don Griffin, who first described the use of sonar by bats. And that's the instrument mm-hmm. with which he recorded them.
Listening devices become key to just finding out the very, very basics of the forest elephant in a distribution and abundance, mm-hmm. where they are, when they're there, are their daily cycles, are their seasonal cycles, and it would just be impossible to get that information any other way, really. So, and that's the kind of level that we're at in the Elephant Listening Project at the moment, is still a very basic, where are these elephants? And what are these cycles and what seems mm-hmm. to influence their kind of activity patterns mm-hmm. at the thighs. And then we're kind of hoping one day to get time to study more about right. what they're saying to each other and what that means.
There were some periods in both of the populations we were studying in which there was a lot of repetition even of portions of phrases. So the phrase might go whoop, 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 and that might repeat several times, and then we'd get you see, it seems as though there's a little rhyme there. And sometimes three or four themes, as we were calling them, were really very similar in what we were calling the endings. You could also call it the beginnings. But anyway, we decided, okay, let's refer to that as rhyming. And then we thought about the old poet, Homer, with his rosy-fingered dawn, the reiterative portions of the song, and how those were probably mnemonic devices to help the listener who has nothing written down because it was all oral, right? Keep the listener moving along and yet oriented to his place in the song.
Do you know the lemurs of Madagascar? This is the big black and white one with gold eyes that you often see pictures of. Mm-hmm. This is a family group. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are obviously not great apes, but most of the great apes around the world have these long-distance calls that serve the function of long-distance propagation to let family groups know, you know, we made it through the night. Howler monkeys, gibbons, those are all great apes. And, of course, there's no great apes here in Madagascar, but these animals are occupying a very similar place in the ecosystem. We know that species in certain behavioral circumstances interact, or there's a system involved that crosses species, crosses major animal groups. Mammals are aware of alarm calls of birds. Birds are aware of alarm calls of animals, and they're all tuned into it.
And other species, and it looks indications are that other species are picking up on this too, and it may be actually fairly, I mean, at least the theory is that it may be really finely coded. You know, this is a large predator, it's a small predator.
We think of it as a contact call, so contact is anybody out there?
And they have, alarm calls that can translate from between different species. But I don't know if they've studied the syntax of songs giving meaning. So it's people doing stuff like looking for phonemes in gorilla vocalizations. And people have done things with crows, with caterpillar noises, which is really neat.
Wow. What kind of noises do caterpillars make?
They were one of the ones that transmit their noises through plant matter. Mm. So they, you know, scratch or scrape and then listen through the stalk of the plant.
This is a field out in the Virginia countryside. And this is just what you hear walking around in a backyard there on an afternoon. If you could focus your ears down tight to a very small space in that field, you might hear this. That is an insect, a tree hopper. It's about the size of a pea. And there are lots of insects out there doing the same thing, or something like it. These creatures don't have large diaphragms to move a lot of air and create sound. So they make sound. They communicate by vibrating the twigs and stems that they live on. And that's what you're hearing.
I went and spent a week sitting in the zoo. Didn't discover anything, just sat there. Every now and then I felt a throbbing in the air, and I thought that was funny. I felt it only near the elephants. And on the way home in the airplane, I thought, by golly, maybe that was sound that was so powerful. I was feeling it, and yet so low-pitched that I, as a human, couldn't hear it. We spent a month in the zoo with equipment borrowed from Cornell and established that here was this range of communication that biologists hadn't known about.
And when I started this, I thought there were a few people around who still remembered the bird from the 1930s and, you know, early 1940s. They were still alive. A lot of them were really old. And I started thinking, if this bird is really extinct, we're losing our living connection with these birds. And I thought, if I can just record every question I can think of and talk to these people, and sometimes for a whole state, and I'd get 30 people with the same name, and I was just like a salesman doing cold calls. I'd have a list of these phone numbers, and I'd go down and say, "This is Tim Gallagher from Cornell, and I want to talk to you about that ivory-billed woodpecker you saw in 1952. And I said, like, "What the hell?" You know, I just hang up and go, "Sorry," go to the next one.
One of my favorites is this group of birds called Oropendulas. And they just make these amazing sounds. And I studied Oropendulas for 6 years, not their sounds and not the acoustics, but I studied their mating system. And I have a strong, you know, love in my heart for those birds. And hearing them, they sound very otherworldly. So hearing them always brings back memories, and I love it. People talk about smells triggering memories. You know, I'm sure you've heard that. And I'm convinced that as people learn to use their ears more, sounds can do the same thing. And you hear something, and it can bring a big memory back. And then the other favorite of mine, for similar but almost opposite reasons, is also from Costa Rica. I love the sound of the common potu, and that's a nocturnal bird that just has this sort of haunting call. In the jungle one day, and it took me almost 20 hours to get back to a place where I knew I was. I had no food or water, all that kind of thing. When I got back to where I was, it was nightfall, and I knew I was going to be safe, so I camped there that night, and in the tree above me that night was a potu, and it was calling all night long, and just this mournful, slow, wailing song, and it was just the most beautiful thing I ever heard. So every time I hear that sound now, I think of that time that I, you know, got really lost but found myself.
We don't have to listen to sound because we use the sounds by turning them into pictures. So we use some software that converts the sound into a visual, you know, a picture, right, of the sound, which you can hear as well when you want to. But our main task is to go through sound files by looking at them, mm-hmm. which might sound a bit strange to people who've never seen a spectrogram, but we can view 24 hours of sound. You can just kind of page through like a musical scroll, just paging through this sound, looking for calls, looking for a picture that looks like an elephant call. Uh-huh. You go through a sort of training session of kind of listening to things and looking at them at the same time, but eventually you can get so that you can just recognize by the picture, oh, that's an elephant call, or oh, that's a tree fall, or oh, wow, that's a bird flap.
Learning about spectrograms and then seeing sheet music as a different kind of spectrogram mm-hmm. has been fun. So, I mean, some people can just do it in their brains, mm-hmm. can listen to a bird song and translate that to a human mm-hmm. scale, but I think most of us, at least at the beginning, need some computational aid to understand mm-hmm. what they're saying. You can quantify things way mm-hmm. better right. mechanically, and that lets you compare birds that you might not be able to compare by ear. So things like how a bird song changes from his first year to his second year or whatever, mm-hmm. You can't really do that as much by ear. For me, it's very important. Just having it laid out there and in a format where your eye can explore it instead of just having it blow past you. I think you can, when you can look at the curves and everything on your own time, that makes it a lot easier to understand what you're hearing.
Are there sounds you can see that you can't hear?
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to hear sort of some of the infrasonic stuff that that we can see on the screen that you can sort of pinpoint out. We have like a natural button, which is just the normal speed, not sped up sound, not slowed down. And if you listen to natural, sometimes you don't hear the elephants at all. We're seeing the elephant calls on the screen, like we were saying, and you go to listen to it and you expect to hear this beautiful elephant trumpet and you hear absolutely nothing. You know the elephant calls there, and you're listening to it and you can hear the birds and the trees and the bugs and splashing, but you don't hear the elephants. And you know they're there because the screen says they're there, but you sort of have to remind yourself that, okay, but they're there and they're communicating with each other and maybe I'm not meant to hear that, but it's there.
Right.
We do have a lot of people upstairs using Raven to look at night flight calls. They get these like rivers of birds flowing overhead at night, and you can't, you know, count them in normal means because it's dark. But they make these little calls when they fly. Yeah, and you can, if you compare them, the spectrograms, you can sort of identify what species you're looking at, and so you can take a census of the birds in a way that you wouldn't be able to do.
So the marks on the spectrograms are actually different enough.
Yeah.
You can distinguish species by the kind of
and they developed
sound
this like Rosetta Stone of night flight calls, so they could compare these little chirpy noises with which species they were from.
Like I've been scanning through a thunderstorm, like a big chunk of time with thunderstorms, and that completely wipes out sort of all of the sounds. Mm. So you lose all of the real-time, like spatio-temporal feel, because I can scan through 2 hours and two minutes. And just press next and not have to listen to any of it. And so it's kind of a time warp, a computer-induced time warp. Right.
One of my favorite examples with Raven is, I think I showed it to you guys, where so the human voice is very harmonic, whereas a whistle doesn't have any harmonics. If you look at the spectrogram, you've got the bass tone, which is the tone that you understand your voice to be speaking at, but then you've got a bunch of other higher tones above that at specific intervals. It's because of how things vibrate,
the vocal cords vibrating.
And you get it with guitar strings. You can see a human voice looks stripy, whereas a pure tone like a whistle or certain kinds of bird calls is just a single line. And if you get a nuthatch, which is sort of honky, that's going to have a lot of harmonics, or a crow, which is hoarse, will have a lot of harmonics. And the shape of the harmonics and the structure and which ones are prominent determine sort of the tone of the voice, and also determine what vowel sound we hear. So the only difference between ah and oo is what harmonic structure you're looking at.
Yeah. So you can actually see the vowels.
Yeah. Looking at how we are as animals is good for you, right?
We also have in-house software where we can generate long-term spectrogram to understand the noise floor in that area. Let's say we have data from Massachusetts Bay from last 10 years, and we can plot them in a map or plot them in the database to see how this noise environment is changing. And we can also plot the whales, both their vocalization frequency band and also their listening frequency band, and see where those noise interference is coming in that whale band, if you will. So this is how basically we are using and analyzing our data and trying to interpret the acoustic habitat where these whales are living. If you see this solid line over there, the Boston Shipping Channel, which is called the TSS, this used to be the shipping channel. And as you can see, this cut directly across one of the most high concentration area for right whales. And based on research and policy advocacy and regulations, in 2007 they moved that shipping channel from this solid line to this dotted line to minimize the ship strike.
What we have sometimes done is put out what you call an array of recording units, so you know, several recording units, more than three recording units in a ring. Like for us, we put them around a forest clearing, and when you've got that arrangement, you can, because the sound takes a different amount of time to reach each recording unit, you can use that information to calculate where the animal was when it made the sound, the call. Gunshots is another big important part of our work. We look for gunshots in the data, and that can help guide anti-poaching patrols.
What does a gunshot look like?
Just like a very sharp, straight line, because it's just an impulse. Just a good one is very easy to recognize, but they're in fact quite difficult to distinguish. If they're a bit further away, they're quite difficult to distinguish from tree falls or even a close branch snapping right next to the microphone or a drop of rain falling on top of the microphone or something strange like that, you know.
If you become obsessed with the visual, you stop listening with the ear, and actually the ear is much more precise. So we, for instance, give me an hour of recording in the African forest, and I'll be able to hear all kinds of elephant calls that we will not discern in the spectrograms, because we haven't trained the machine to be as discerning as the ear is.
I wouldn't be doing my humpback whales justice if I didn't say the humpback whale song, just because I think it's absolutely haunting.
The Beatles, right?
Right. Okay.
And John Cage, was exposed to John Cage early on in high school, and got my degree in composition and worked with Radio Expeditions. And
oh, I was really interested in learning to play an instrument when I was a little kid. I played a lot of different instruments. I ended up studying with a person named George Cacioppo, who was one of the co-founders of this experimental performance group called the Once Group in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we used to just we had a lesson for about an hour where we just argue about the notes that I had written, and then he would talk to me for, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. But somebody with a ability to sort of decompose the sound around them, you know, like a lot of trained musicians can do that, might say, well, yeah, I can hear this sound, but I feel that beat. You know, they may be able to make that distinction. It's connected with the way that sound happens outside of a human construction. It's up to the listener to create the space and create the music through the listening process.
I play piano, so there's that.
But we had music in our life. Meeting Roger Payne, who was a scraggly graduate student, when I was an undergraduate, I was studying music, and he was studying birds, and we met playing and singing in the Bach St. Matthew Passion together.
I can remember just being fascinated with that radio on top of the fridge, and this music coming out of it, all popular music, and I got into, my brother and I were both got into music a little bit, just as kids, banging on drums and playing guitars, and then I was just always attracted to sound and fascinated with my father's phonograph, and he worked for RCA Laboratories, and he brought home tape machines and things that never really took off commercially, or just bizarre looking cassettes with reel to reel tape in them.
I was always really musical growing up. I played the flute. I dabbled in the tuba for a year. That was an odd happening, but and then the same thing, I was always very interested in animal behavior. I've worked on whale watch boats, and sort of whales are definitely at the forefront of acoustics, especially sort of when I was growing up. That was the hot, like, sexy science in whale research, was putting microphones under the water. The scientist in me that's been taking classes says animal behavior, but
right.
The romantic in me says the music came
right,
first.
Right.
Well, I love wood thrush, which I guess you've worked with too. I think that's the most beautiful bird song.
What do you love about the wood thrush?
Just the quality of its tones. It's like sort of echoey and haunting.
Beep.
like I hear them, I walk home through the woods, and whenever you hear it, it just sort of stops you. It's not like any of the other birds. It's like the whole woods is singing.
In many cases, these vocalizations are a window into the evolutionary relationships of these organisms. The ossines, the true songbirds, and that includes things like nightingale, cardinal, robin. Early impressions gained from sound are borne out by the genetics. If they don't hear pops sing, they go through a development of song just like we go through development of speech. Right. If we don't hear speech properly spoken, and if we're not able to hear, we don't have that feedback loop, we don't develop the right sound. Driving the development of these vocalizations is sexual selection. Female preference, female mate choice, drives what males do, and song is a major component there. And it's not just male birds that sing. Mm-hmm. As you move closer to the equator, the prevalence of song in females goes up exponentially. They use song for, in many species, mate bonding. And if you remove one mate, the first thing they start doing is they'll start singing, and when a new mate arrives, they duet. And duetting is a major component in many tropical species, and that's pair bond maintenance.
Darwin proposed sexual selection as a sort of a special case or a special form of natural selection back, you know, when he proposed natural selection. Then he subsequently wrote an entire book on it in 1871. Nobody bought the idea of sexual selection or especially female mating preferences, female choice. It was literally not till the 1970s, so 100 years after Darwin proposed, that people got serious about actually testing the idea. We have indications, certainly, of aspects of song that clearly are the targets of sexual selection, been shaped by sexual selection. One of the birds I study is a black-throated blue warbler, and the males go zoo, 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 zee. And we've shown that the faster those males can do that zoo, 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 the more the females like it and the more young they sire. And then if it is female mating preferences, why in the world would a female prefer a male who has a faster zoo, 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 for example? I think that a lot of scientists are actually sort of agnostic on that question and are willing to think, yeah, maybe they do have an aesthetic sense or a sense of pleasure and maybe even self-awareness or whatnot, but we can't study that very effectively, at least, you know, because we at least try to be objective and base what we do on data we can gather objectively, and you can't very well or very easily assess something like aesthetic preference. And the way I would phrase it, that is, that's a different level of analysis that may or may not be happening. The animal may be really, I think that male's tail is pretty, you know, I'm attracted to it because it's pretty. On a different level of analysis, though, it affects passing of genes from one generation to the next, and that's something we can measure and focus on. Mm-hmm. And so those are complementary views, not opposing views, in my view.
The function of the song is a matter of controversy, but it's pretty clear to me that everybody's right, that it is, like bird song, involved in establishing a territory in courtship, in male-to-male competition. It's much more intense, and the singing is, more whales are singing more of the time during the mating season than during the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And new versions were appearing, always more similar to the song before than to what would occur, you know, over a 5-year period. But this was as rapid as evolution, more rapid than evolution in human communication, except perhaps something like the locker room lingo, you know, where the guys are competing with and using new phrases and on and on. You see, this phenomenon is cultural evolution, about which we know very little in animals other than the human. But for whales, I think they're the fruit fly of cultural evolution, because there we see the thing evolving through its own devices.
Almost like natural, I think, almost like primeval sort of call is a loon to me.
Everyone loves the call of the loon, I do too.
There's concern over things like petrochemical exploration, you know, oil and gas exploration, the sounds that animals are contending with there, and having the baseline recordings that preceded and then were concurrent and followed those sorts of efforts. People want those recordings, and it's a major issue.
Right.
Most people are completely unaware of the impact of commerce in the world's oceans. The soundscape, where animals really perceive their world through sound. I mean, animals do terrestrially as well, and I think that's something people don't really fully appreciate what's going on. If you could see it, like if it were almost like synesthesia, that, you know, if you could see these sound waves propagating and have an impression of how animals perceive their world terrestrially, it'd be pretty phenomenal. But in the world's oceans, it's a matter of fact. Hundreds of miles or thousands of miles separate organisms, and yet they're communicating through the acoustic environment of the world's oceans. You send a few cargo ships through there whose props are not designed to do anything but propel the ship. They generate so much noise, it's unbelievable, and it masks the ability of these organisms to communicate.
The whale species that we are working with is called North Atlantic right whales. And this is one of the most highly endangered baleen whale species in the world. And there is the estimate is there is somewhere about 400, 500 of these individuals left in the world.
As fun as these are to listen to, we love to listen to them. I mean, we're just absolutely captivated by this stuff, which is one of our motivations for doing it and sharing it with others. These very same recordings are being used for conservation purposes as well. So if you want to try and reintroduce Atwater's prairie chickens to a site that's suitable, you can take birds raised in captivity, and one of the things they're attempting to do is recreate the sound of an active lek, because the birds become tied to a lekking site. No matter how much the site degrades, once they start lekking there, they stay lekking. So they're using playback techniques there. Playback techniques are used incredibly effectively with seabird colonies. So we're going to start out with a bird, Atwater's prairie chicken, which there used to be millions of these birds along the Texas-Louisiana Gulf Coast. Their numbers decimated through development of that area, oil, gas, cattle ranches, everything you can imagine, of course, along the Texas-Louisiana Gulf Coast. And there's one active lek, which is near Texas City, Texas. It's about a 3,000-acre preserve that's hemmed in by interstate highway, facilities for dealing with petroleum, oil, gas. It's right across the harbor from where the BP facility caught fire, exploded, not so many years ago. The hurricanes have hit twice there since this recording was made in 2004. Last we knew, there was only one bird, one male, active on the lek. At this time, there were nine. It gives you an idea of what prairie chickens may have sounded like. Males do three things. They dance in place, a little pattering sound. They walk, walk, walk. That's a beak-to-beak challenge, male to male. And then they boom with twin air sacs. There are two females standing there silently.
What is it about extinction that focuses the attention for you?
Well, it's all about loss. It's all about there's this beautiful thing that I can't see, or no one can see anymore. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like such a tragedy. Mm-hmm. We went down there. We had recordings of the ivory-billed woodpecker from the Cornell expedition of 1935. And we also had this box that Marchand Lamartine made that you tie to a tree, and there's a knocker thing, two broomsticks, short broomsticks with a bolt in the middle, so you whack this box and then the other part of the broomstick comes over and hits it again, and it makes a perfect Campephalus woodpecker double knock, bam bam, with the second one being almost like an echo of the first. Followed up by going to Mexico after the imperial woodpecker, which is the closest relative of an ivory bill, but much bigger, like about a third bigger. The last documented sighting was in 1956 when this guy from Pennsylvania took a movie of a lone female. Anyway, we went out to this area. We went to some areas. We'd found on Google Earth areas that were completely uncut near where this movie had been made. And we went out there and we were playing these calls and making those double knocks, and I just remember one time when it was like around sunset, and just hearing that and realize, you know, that was so sad to me, hearing the sound that isn't part of the soundscape anymore, because it became increasingly obvious that they were long gone from that part of Durango. And then we finally we talked to this old Tepehuana, and he told us in the early 1950s, the logging interests had come in and they encouraged people to kill these birds. They said, these birds are destroying valuable timber and they got to be destroyed. And not only did they encourage them to shoot them and things like that, but they gave them poison. They showed them how to smear it on the foraging trees. And they'd fed on these poison trees, I figured, you know. And that was sad, and just hearing that sound, and we did it for day after day, and
never got a response.
No. And yeah, that was sad.
At the moment, all we've got time to do is say, are the elephants there or not? It's sure. A bit of a race against time, because these elephants are being poached very badly at the moment, so we haven't got time to just sort of get into the niceties of science, you know?
It seems to me that we're living in a time when people are more and more separated from the natural world, not only because there's so many people and so many are urban, but also because there isn't attention for it. And I grieve about that. How can we hope that something that's unknown will be protected or would be primary in people's concerns? The elephant study, which started off in a kind of ecstasy of discovery and of wondering who these creatures are, led into the great sorrow that both of these species are endangered by human behaviors. As soon as that began to happen, the Lab of Ornithology, which had, of course, the library of sounds from all kinds of animals, took on a very new meaning and a new obligation, a sense of responsibility not only to make these sounds known to people and available to them to listen to, but also to go out and fight for the lives of the animals.
You know, actually, one of my favorite sounds in the archive isn't even in the archive. It's a friend of mine sent it because he caught this starling out in front of his place one morning, just going berserk, making all these sounds. You know, it's another one of these, you know, these mimicry kind of birds, like the mockingbird and others. And it's like a 2-minute recording of this bird, which clearly is. And I played it for Greg Budney, the curator. It's quite a repertoire of stuff, including like screw guns. You know, hammering sounds, dogs in the distance, you know, like it knows how to make that muffled, rolled off high frequency response of the dog in the distance. I mean, it's a fascinating recording to me because of everything that's in there, including like electronic loopers. Like this guy has a studio right there at his place, and he'll often leave some, you know, like electronic loops running like for hours on end or something. And the bird is living around there, and like in the beginning of the recording, it clearly is doing some cyclical stuff that is not like natural sounds you hear outside. Like it's been hanging around that property for a while, and it's just fascinating to listen to all the stuff this one bird can do in 2 minutes, man.